Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today's show features Andrew Bacevich, a well-known analyst of U.S. foreign policy. I hope you'll stay tuned. At New World Notes, we'll often devote a half-hour installment or a pair of installments to a single figure. John Perkins, most recently. And before that, Bruce Gagnon, Michael Parenti, Susan Rosenthal, and several others. This week, it's Andrew Bacevich. Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. Before that, he was an army officer for many years, a colonel when he retired in the 1990s. He and I did not exactly move in the same circles. In 1969, the year I declared myself a conscientious objector to war, he graduated from West Point. Politically, I find him conservative and very, very establishment, a far cry from the lefty troublemakers this show usually features. But his conservatism and his military experience have made him all the more effective when he criticizes the self-destructive warmongering the U.S. has been doing for well over a century. Kind of like the Marine Corps General Smedley Butler, who wrote the famous pamphlet War is a Racket about 75 years ago. Like Butler, Professor Bacevich is a very smart guy. He's also very knowledgeable about world history, military and diplomatic history, and political science. He's the author of 5 books on U.S. foreign and national security policy. His most recent, from 2010, is titled Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. In a minute, I'll read a brief article by Bacevich, one he wrote this year, and we'll hear parts of a recently recorded interview. Stay tuned. Mickey Mouse's body bag is FedEx from Kabul. Minnie Mouse wonders why the bags are full. Oligarchs and all barons tell Walt Disney the news. John Wayne marches off to war in Donald Duck's shoes.
1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Me, I don't give a damn. Next stop, Afghanistan. 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Ain't no time to wonder why. We're all gonna die. 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop, Afghanistan. 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates.
Once you've been shot at, you really can't come down. There's nothing, you can't top that.
1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Fighting for. No one here gets out alive. 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Fighting for. No one here gets out alive.
This is Andrew Bacevich, published in Counterpunch, June 28, 2011, and condensed and edited for radio by me. It's titled, Is America Coming to Its Senses? From time to time, Americans are gripped by messianic war fever. It comes and goes. It declined after the fall of Saigon in 1975, then increased after the fall of communism. Then came 9/11, and the fever simply soared off the charts. The Messiah nation was really kicked off and was going to fix things once and for all. 10 years have passed since Washington set out to redeem the greater Middle East. The Crusades have not gone well. In fact, in the pursuit of its saving mission, the American Messiah has pretty much worn itself out. Today, the post-9/11 war fever finally shows signs of abating. The evidence is partial and preliminary. The sickness has by no means passed. Oddly, it lingers most strongly in the White House. Obama's keenness to express American ideals by dropping bombs seems strangely undiminished. Yet American recovery has become a distinct possibility. Here's some of the evidence. In Washington, it's no longer considered a sin to question American omnipotence. Take the case of Robert Gates. The recently retired Secretary of Defense may well be the one senior U.S. official of the past decade to leave office with his reputation not only intact, but actually enhanced. His legacy was his willingness to acknowledge the limits of American power. That the United States should avoid wars except when absolutely necessary no longer connotes isolationism. It is once again a sign of common sense. Gates was a leading promoter. Modesty is becoming respectable. A half dozen years ago, wars of choice were all the rage in Washington. No more. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The officer corps itself seems to be rethinking the role of military power. Consider, for example, Mr. Y., author of a national strategic narrative published this spring. The actual authors of this report are two military professionals, one a Navy captain, the other a Marine colonel. What you won't find in this document are jingoism, braggadocio, chest thumping, and calls for a bigger military budget. If there's an overarching theme, it's pragmatism. Rather than the United States imposing its will on the world, the authors want more attention paid to the investment needed to rebuild at home. The world is too big and complicated for any one nation to call the shots, they insist. The effort to do so is self-defeating. As Americans, Mr. Y. writes, we needn't seek the world's friendship or proselytize the virtues of our society. Neither do we seek to bully, intimidate, cajole, or persuade others to accept our unique values or to share our national objectives. Rather, we will let others draw their own conclusions based on our actions. We will pursue our national interests and let others pursue theirs. Quote, unquote. Now, this is no scientific sample, but the captains, majors, and lieutenant colonels I hear from broadly agree with Mr. Y. They've had a bellyful of 21st century American war and are open to a real debate over how to overhaul the nation's basic approach to national security. And finally, by gum, there is the United States Congress. Just when that body appeared to have entered a permanent vegetative state, a flickering of intelligent life has made its reappearance. Democrats and Republicans alike, albeit for different reasons, are raising serious questions about the nation's fondness for multiple open-ended wars. Some members cite concern for the Constitution and the abuse of executive power. Others worry about the price tag. With Osama bin Laden out of the picture, still others insist it's time to rethink strategic priorities. No doubt partisan calculation or personal ambition figures alongside matters of principle. They are, after all, politicians. Since polls show a growing public unhappiness over the Afghan war, speaking out against that war these days doesn't exactly require political courage. Still, the possibility of our legislators reasserting a role in deciding whether or not a war actually serves the national interest, rather than simply rubber-stamping appropriations and slinking away, now presents itself. God bless the United States Congress. Basevich continues, granted, the case presented here falls well short of being conclusive. President Obama himself seems uncertain of where he stands. And clogging the corridors of power are plenty of folks still hankering to have a go at Syria or Iran. At the first signs of self-restraint, you can always count on the likes of Senator John McCain or the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal to decry, as McCain put it, an isolationist withdrawal, lack of knowledge of history attitude. Hell-bent on pulling up the drawbridge and having Americans turn their backs on the world. To these people, war fever is a permanent condition, and it's always 104 degrees and rising. Yet it is a measure of how quickly things are changing that McCain himself, once deemed a source of straight talk, now comes across as a mere crank. In this way, nearly a decade after our most recent descent into madness, the possibility of recovery finally beckons. End of Is America Coming to His Senses? By Andrew Bacevich.
1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop, Afghanistan. 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates.
Nice musical medley assembled by Skidmark Bob of Pop Defect Radio out in Santa Cruz. PopDefectRadio.blogspot.com. That featured a truly spooky remake of Country Joe's Woodstock-era anti-war classic, Feels Like I'm Fixin' to Die. How easy it was just to take out Vietnam and substitute Afghanistan. Not just in the song, but also in U.S. foreign policy. We're making the same mistake in Afghanistan that we made in Vietnam, except that we, that is, we the people, don't have any control over the Pentagon. And what they're doing is evil, but it's not a mistake. They, the Pentagon, know what they're doing, and if we don't know, shame on us. Let's just say that any discussion of Afghanistan that does not include the words Caspian oil, control, and pipeline to the Arabian Sea is just propaganda. And any discussion of Afghanistan that does include the word democracy is just propaganda. Here's a nice interview with Andrew Bacevich with Jeff Blankfort of the radio show Takes on the World. Bacevich doesn't focus on Afghanistan, except to note that the war is destroying our relationship with Pakistan, and Pakistan is of far greater strategic importance. Bacevich focuses on the U.S.'s general policy of global interventionism, which has plagued the world since the end of World War II. He starts by discussing the U.S. campaign against Iran. Here is Andrew Bacevich speaking with Jeff Blankfort.
I'm probably not as concerned about an attack on Iran as your remarks suggest. There certainly are people beating the war drums, but I think they tend to be neoconservatives or the reflexively hawkish members of the United States Senate. And those folks don't necessarily have a lot of clout and credibility at the moment. My guess, and it's only a guess, would be that the military itself will not be especially keen to start another war. The military, a decade into this mess, certainly has its hands full. So getting the generals and admirals to go along with an attack on Iran at this juncture, I think, would be pretty difficult. They'll do what they're told to do at the end of the day, but they'll be asked their opinion about a war before it begins. And my guess is that their opinions are going to be negative about opening up an Iranian front to go along with all the other fronts.
There's been talk in Israel about Israel attacking Iran, and that would, of course, sooner or later involve the United States. What do you think possibly that might be?
I think that's a much higher likelihood. Again, I don't pretend to have any inside information about decisions in the Israeli government, but Israelis in the face of what they perceive to be a threat, are inclined to shoot first and get around to asking permission later. We have the attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor 2 decades ago as a precedent in many respects. The 1967 war is a precedent, or more recently, the incursion into Gaza, Operation Cast Lead. The Israelis probably have, if not capabilities sufficient to eliminate the Iranian program, certainly they could do great damage to it. And I think your comment is right, that were the Israelis to attack Iran, the perception would be, whether accurate or not, the perception would be that we had given them the green light, and so in one way or another, we probably would be dragged into whatever occurred in the wake of such an attack.
And, of course, certainly they'd have the support of members of Congress.
One could anticipate that a vast majority of both parties in Congress would cheer for Israel, as they reflexively do. One of the things that I cling to is my conviction that if you really want to know the big truths about U.S. policy, you don't look for differences between Republicans and Democrats. You look for the continuities. And I think that when it comes to national security policy, the continuities between the days of Harry Truman and the days of Barack Obama are massive. And in particular, I think that the defining themes of U.S. national security policy reduced to what I call in the book a sacred trinity, namely that we design our forces not to defend the country, but to provide instruments of power projection, that we then establish, maintain a global military presence, and that we, with considerable frequency, marry those power projection capabilities and that global presence together to support policies of global interventionism. That's what we do. That is the essence of the national security tradition that's existed since the end of World War II, and it continues to exist today. I mean, it is astonishing, really, that President Obama, who advertised himself as an agent of fundamental change, it's astonishing the extent to which he has embraced that sacred trinity and made it his own. You just alluded a second ago to the introduction of a small number of U.S. forces into sub-Saharan Africa, and I think that we don't know where that escapade is going to lead us, but I think that's emblematic of this sacred trinity now being applied in what could well be a brand new theater of operations. I think what this tends to discourage me is how little we as a people are able to learn from our experiences. I mean, to me it is astonishing that the United States, our fellow citizens, have for all practical purposes flushed the Iraq War down the memory hole already. It's not even over, and it's already forgotten. There's been remarkably little effort to extract lessons from that experience, to understand why we went to war, to understand why the war went so badly. It's just something that we wish to set aside, flush down the drain. And that penchant, that absence of consciousness on our part, is one of the things that discourages me.
So for Basevich, the people are handicapped by the disinclination to learn from experience, even recent experience. He goes on to say we're also handicapped by ignoring the military since Nixon abolished the draft. Here I'd add that our politicians and the corporate news media do everything possible to encourage this public ignorance. Back to Andrew Basevich.
I do think that more recently policymakers, I think this was very true in the George W. Bush administration, have exploited the fact that the military has become detached from society. They've exploited that fact in promoting policies that they wanted to promote. They anticipated that the American people would have a short attention span or limited interest in the wars that they began. So they were quite shrewd, I think, in taking advantage of this fact.
Well, certainly the average American, if they could find Afghanistan, let alone Pakistan, on the map, have really no idea what's going on over there. And unfortunately, they don't care much about it. And the argument that are made in the halls of Congress of why we should remain in Afghanistan is if the Taliban or the Haqqani network is some threat to Americans and American soil, this is never discussed.
Well, it's stated but then not demonstrated. This is another puzzle. It is true that the 9/11 attacks were planned in Afghanistan. It's not true that the 9/11 attacks were launched from Afghanistan or that the attackers were Afghans. I mean, they were, for the most part, Saudis. And so that the notion that were we to pacify Afghanistan, that the so-called terrorist threat would go away doesn't pass the laugh test. Al-Qaeda is a threat, albeit not an existential one, but Al-Qaeda does not require Afghanistan to serve as a sanctuary. And what's more troubling still is, it seems pretty clear, that the effort to pacify Afghanistan has the unintended consequence of destabilizing Pakistan. And the fact of the matter is, the fate of Pakistan is of far greater importance, orders of magnitude greater importance to us than is the fate of Afghanistan. So we're actually creating a very large problem in our effort to fix a problem that we have overblown.
And this is one of the contributions that President Obama has made, because actually he did keep two promises. One was to expand the war in Afghanistan and also to expand the war in Pakistan. And I think you might say a large responsibility for the destabilization of Pakistan falls at his doorstep.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. And given the fact that President Obama is, I think, clearly a very smart guy, in many respects a very shrewd guy, quite frankly, the magnitude of his errors in that regard just seems surprising. I myself don't understand how a guy who is, I think, as smart as he is, would have gone down the path, again, specifically with regard to what we're doing in Pakistan, which strikes me as, you know, just set aside all moral considerations, set aside legal considerations, just focus on whether what we're doing is smart or stupid. And I think it's pretty clearly stupid.
Finally, Blankford asks Basevich about today's hot new military technology, remote-controlled drones. Basevich's response to these new destructive toys is unenthusiastic. He suggests that we put these toys in a broader context of policy. And he suggests that it wouldn't hurt our understanding in the least to read a little history. And on that point, he earns New World Notes' wholehearted agreement.
I wanted to talk to you about the impact and the ramifications of the use of drones, which have a very nice sleepy name, but seem to be no different than F-15s without pilots, and the fact that they're able to be manufactured for such a low cost that countries around the world are all trying to make them and succeeding to do that. What effect do you think that is going to have? The impact is that going to have on future U.S. policy?
Well, I think it's another one of these technological developments that persuade the policymakers that this is a low-cost way to use force. Probably leads people to pay too much attention to the near term and not think about the long term. I mean, to the extent that today there are only a handful of countries that can develop the kinds of drones that we're using, almost inevitably, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, there will be many, many countries that are able to build and deploy drones. Do we really want to have a world in which this basically policy of targeted assassination disregarding sovereignty is commonplace? Because if that's the world we live in, then we ourselves could well be subject to the consequences. It's not simply going to be a matter of us flying over somebody else's territory to kill somebody we want to kill. That could happen here in the United States. So it seems to me that people need to curb their enthusiasm a little bit and try to think through the longer-term consequences of this new weapon system.
Well, from your long experience actually in the military, as apart from sitting in an editorial boardroom or a congressional office, you actually have seen war. What would you advise people to do at this point in time, if you could give some advice to our listeners?
Well, I think as you suggested a couple of minutes ago, we need to be smarter at decoding the news, of understanding the real significance of what we're told. I mean, I think the drone thing is a good example. That it gets reported in the news as now as an almost an everyday event that there was a drone attack by the U.S. that killed some nameless person in Pakistan. But instead of simply reading that dispatch, we need to be smart enough to be able to connect it to the larger course of events in Pakistan, to understand the history of U.S.-Pakistani relations going back over several decades. We have to be able to put things in a context, and probably reading history is a good way to develop the ability to put things in a larger context.
You've been hearing the printed and spoken words of foreign policy analyst Andrew Bacevich. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for the music and to Jeff Blankford for the interview. And thank you, dear listener, for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. This show has a free email newsletter. Send me a note if you'd like to subscribe. You'll find my email address on the show's website, and that is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Then I'll get to my non-carborundum, and ciao.
And marches alone can't bring integration when human respect is disintegrating. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me.